introduce our guest, Coach Curtis Frye, the head coach of men and women's track and field at the University of South Carolina, the man, the myth, the legend, national championship winning coach, Hall of Famer. I don't know how many Olympians you've coached, Coach, and how many champions, but your resume is obviously very extensive, and I actually ran for Coach Frye at the University of South Carolina, and I'm going to say he was my motivation for actually becoming a head coach. So, yeah. Anyway, Coach Frye, you know, this is it's a track and field podcast, but we're not really, it doesn't necessarily have to be about track and field. You know, we're not talking workouts and things like that. I want to just hear about, you know, your journey and how you became a head coach in the first place, you know, the things that you've had to overcome, you know, especially being a black man. And, you know, you've been highly successful. And I just, you know, just want to hear how everything came together for you.
Hey, it wasn't intentional. I really, coaching was not what I originally wanted to do. I really wanted to be a person that went to West Point and go on in the military, because my role models were my uncles and my dad, and my day-to-day hard work guy that had a ninth grade education that my mother got back to do a GED, because she was a high school graduate and went on to college with me. My mom was in class with me at a community college. She was a lady that everyone said, don't get a class with that old lady because she messes up the curve. At 53 years old, my mother graduated. I hid from where my mother was because that was the person they were talking about when I was just trying to just get through. I wanted to be an 18-year-old having fun and sometime taking a car and going over to the high school to meet my girlfriend, who later became my wife. Okay. I made it through JUCO. I became a student, and I didn't get to West Point because my literary ability wasn't good. I wrote some letters. They wanted me to go to a prep school. I couldn't see my way into prep school to get into Army. So I went on to East Carolina University, where I met Bill Carson. I wanted to be a lawyer because my mother and father had built up a reputation. They integrated me into public schools when the South, one of the first back in 1965. And those things, I didn't want to be. My brother and I, the only black kid in elementary school, and we grew to play sports there, and we were able to have success and take pictures in the newspaper with our classmates, and because we were hugging, crosses were burning in front of my house, and
wow,
people shot around where we lived. And
wait a second. We gotta backtrack on this one a little bit. So wait, tell me about crosses burning in front of your house.
Yeah.
Because that's important. I mean, you know, in the current state of our country, these are stories that people don't hear. And people will look at you as a successful head coach and say, you know, he's never faced racism. It's impossible. Look how well he's done. So when you talk about crosses burning on your yard, you know, let's stop there for a second. Tell me about this.
Let's skip over that.
Well, because they're just a microcosm of the block to build me to be able to relate with people who were different. But it was late one night after taking a picture on Tuesday. I only have in my neighborhood or my country town, the newspaper comes out once a week, and on Tuesday, the picture was taken after we won. We were playing against a rival who they had not beaten, and the girls and the boys, which they hadn't won, and we won, and the girls won. Well, there were two white females that were high scorers, and then my brother and I were the high scorers, and so they put me first, the other young lady second, then my brother, and then the other. And we had our arms around each other's back. So Wednesday, nothing. We just go to school. Nobody says anything. Thursday, the paper comes out. That picture's there. And let me reverse. I took the picture on the weekend, and it came out on Tuesday. That's the way it went. So it was taken like Friday, and then it took the weekend, and then it came out that next Tuesday. So then we're washing dishes in the kitchen and looking over the hill, and my brother who went to the high school, he was the only player there that was African American on the high school team, and he was a star football player, and everybody had celebrated the great season he had had. But this particular time, we look on the hill, we saw this beautiful fire.
Oh man!
And just looking out the window, we said, "Come look at the fire." We're eighth graders, seventh and eighth graders, and my brother's a high schooler, and he looked. Well, my dad and he were avid hunters. So my brother grabbed his little .22 rifle and started shooting. And my dad shot the edge of the cross. And then they hear shots back in the woods away from where we were. And so it was an incident. We went to the my dad and them made us stay in the house, and the dogs were going crazy. And before we know it, not for a few nights, all African Americans, hunters, and people came in around our house, because we were the only family that had integrated from right in that part of the country. People had told us, "Don't do this. Why you got a black school?" We were driving 11 to 15 miles in one direction to go to school, but my mother, at that point, who had had NAACP representatives in our home, Roy Wilkins, and it was during the SCLC. We're talking 1964. The preparation was 63 to 64. We were involved in, my mom would drive us to Raleigh to speak at conventions. It was preparations to be a head coach. Yeah. But I didn't know this was preparations. All I knew is once that cross burnt, that meant I didn't have to walk and get on that bus anymore. But my mom got us up. And that was a courageous builder. Walked me to the road and put me on the bus. Everybody on the bus was quiet. We always sit in the middle to the back. That's how the bus had been loaded. This morning, the front two seats were empty. That means everybody in all of the neighborhood for a 6 or 8 mile radius, they knew this had occurred and it was organized.
Wow.
And so, hey, we made it through that school year. We finished playing the season. Things quieted down. The FBI or State Bureau of Investigation tracked the footsteps of the persons through the field that came to our house. And then we end up, my understanding was they were very intelligent. People burnt the cross in the middle of a not in our yard, not on our property, but on the center of the road, which means that's a throughway, and that's not anybody's property. That's public property. So they were never, nobody prosecuted anyone. So that's that story.
Wow.
So you're in seventh grade when this happens. You know, like, we're just getting started with your story, and you tell a pretty intense situation where you're encountering racism, and it's like, you know, there's so many people who just are unaware of these things that happen all the time, and it's just a normal story. You know, seventh grade, this happened, burnt the cross, you know, we had to shoot at the cross. It's, you know, it's crazy.
Yeah. There's strength, all of the things we go through, which you can make you or break you.
Yeah, absolutely.
And but they still leave an impact on everybody. I think my faith and my parents for being available for counseling. Anytime you're surprised with things, because I was assuming that people we won the game. That made me feel like now people are going to love me. Mm-hmm. Well, the kids around me did. They ended up being the best, my lifelong friends. Some of them are some of them watch one section of news, and some watch the same section of news I do. But if it came between, if Kurt says something, I'm Kurt to all of them, even the ones that might be a strong conservative, and I am a liberal, but I'm a Christian liberal. That means I value my Christianity, and I have things that I feel that a conservative would agree with. But I, life, liberty, the pursuit of happiness is something my line. Loving your neighbor, love your family. Those are faith, family is first for me. Those are things that I think just is apple pie. So there's some people that are apple pie, but then they don't think that that minorities work hard enough, and that's why they don't get the same privileges. And that, I got friends that are in the category that you are different, Curtis, because you work hard. No, I didn't work harder than some other minority. In fact, my brother worked harder than me, and he didn't arrive to be the head coach of South Carolina. My role model is my brother James, who had to go to Vietnam, and short come of his education, and was much smarter than me. So I just was fortunate enough to be able to be in the right place at the right time. But I've had a lot of other things happen along this trail.
Mm-hmm. Understandable. So, Coach, and you said you wanted to be in the military at first, and I understand that because my grandfather was a triple nickel. He was in the airborne 555th. He was a paratrooper. So I absolutely can understand that. And then you said you also wanted to be was it a lawyer?
Well, that followed. The whole feeling was because in those days, and my age was – civil rights was huge for me and my family. My mother took our church on its first trip to the beach with by getting $5 and getting a bus to take the whole church when people didn't want to go. My mother integrated the home extension, and my mother was one of the persons that was the first writer of that newspaper for both blacks and whites from my segment of town. So in turn, she was a progressive. Her father told her tongue wouldn't last her lifetime because my mother spoke up. My mother worked as a maid before she became a nurse, and she lost many a jobs because of, as she told me later on, inappropriate touching by persons that she worked on, because she wouldn't tell my dad why she left the job, because she knew that he would probably be killed, and so she would just quit, and they just thought, well, Louise is just quitting jobs is because she couldn't tolerate. She wasn't like her mother before her. She graduated from high school. She was 16 years old. My mother was much more than all of her children who end up with degrees. If she came from another section of the state of North Carolina, she would have graduated from university and been a lawyer. Well, she didn't get those advantages. So I had that kind of support around me daily. My dad in ninth grade, every week he would have finished a book. So reading was paramount. We had newspapers in a country home that had an outhouse in the back, as I mean. Our running water was, we brought the bucket and went and pick up the water out of a well. Those are things that I came through, but those things made me appreciate other things and other people. But I had white neighbors that had the same similar things that we work in the fields with. I primed tobacco when I was 9 years old. I those are things that you go through. I'm 68 years old. I'm 45 years of my 68 being a college coach. There's not very many guys in this profession, even though there are some that are older than me that I listen to, but how long did it take them to even be a college coach? They were high school coaches. I started being a college coach when I left at 23 years old out of college.
Yeah.
So my struggle is my strength.
Right. I think it's important. I mean, you talk about your mom and your dad and how you were reared. It's also important to have those support systems. And it's also important about what you do as a parent. And I think that transitions into heavily influencing what you do as a leader, you know, and as far as what we do as coaches. And to be sure that we're providing opportunities for folks who we're overseeing, you know, so that they can perhaps go off and be better than we are. So
this new era of coach, and the things that the new era coach has been provided, I think it's for granted the past and the considerations of the struggles that people provide them. The appreciations for what y'all call GOATs, because technology has extended past the GOAT. I mean, and that right there is like eliminating the reasons for walking across the bridge in Alabama. I don't know the history that the new coach understands the history and why it's so important to not fail. It's not about not failing to have somebody run fast, but not failing that 5% of African American male that had an opportunity to be in college. It's not failing the 95% of the white America that are observing him every day, that he is honest and has integrity, and that he stands on top of those goats, that those goats went through having the fire burnt in front of their house and people shouting over the top, or that those persons paid a price, that they are just as intelligent and probably more so. I understood something about Dr. Leroy Walker. I read his books. I understand something about Ed Temple or Coach Jacket, that the price that they had paid to be a track coach. Track coach and being an educator was for an African-American community was right near a doctor or a lawyer or an engineer in this day and age. Their appreciation, those persons who were educators were that opportunity. They were bright enough if they could have afforded, like I said, my mother, they missed an opportunity, America, the world did, by not freeing up such that all persons had access, that we probably could have avoided some diseases and some not having had Wall Street be as big as it and the world not being as good a place, because we didn't use the African-American that was bright, because we didn't consider them bright. We didn't use all our resources.
Right.
Our young coach is fortunate. But the responsibility for having to be one has paid a big due. It became in vogue instead of earned. There's some applied success routes that if you got a black guy that ran that has an education, he's or her, that person is going to have the character of the persons that recommend them. And the responsibility to go with that recommendation, I think, is a missing tool. As I sit and talk with Brooks and on that pod the other night, and as I listened to John Smith and Coach Hart a few before, I know both and all of those. There's something people are afraid to address, and it's going to have to be addressed in the next in the next few days, and in all the conventions we go to. And it's not going to be called playing the race card. It's been called becoming educated. Knowing about this country's reputation, I don't think that the young educated African American coach understands that you had some. You're special, but you're not so unique that somebody else couldn't be in your shoes. Well, 1921, a city called Tulsa, Oklahoma, was burnt down. 15,000 black people got burned because they had 51 businesses that were into finance in Tulsa, Oklahoma. Those things that I think if you had in your history books that you would know more, you could appreciate why you got to line up and do, why you can't let that 5% fail. Anyway, I'm rambling. Don't let me ramble.
No. You're making great points, Coach. And I'm going to say, you know, both Portia and I are, you know, as being coaches and being black coaches at you know, some prestigious institutions, is like, no, we understand the responsibility. And I know it's a privilege for me to be able to bring young black men to Cornell and have them graduate and go on to work at Intel or Google or get whatever these jobs are. I know that we're providing opportunities. And for me, that is one of the things that I take away from my job the most. That's what I appreciate about it. And I've seen that path for them of changing people's, you know, their family trajectory. So I agree with you. It is a huge responsibility, but you know, some of us are a little more aware of it, I think.
I would agree some. I just see running fast and knowing how to get over top of wickets becoming the paramount and how good a coach I am. If you're not developing better people, but you're developing faster people, then you're not very good. If you're having inappropriate relationships with the athlete, she runs faster, not the right one.
Yeah.
If you're leaving harmage after they graduate, emotional harmage, I say roadkill on the side of the road that can't get a job and can't go back, and they've been privileged as a collegiate athlete because they put their uniform and walk across campus and they will not experience any racism, and they don't understand that and they hide behind it, but one day they'll go and they're going to have to take it off and drive their car down the road. They're not aware of the how the community in which they live is being treated. Wrong guy. Now, they might not want to hear it, and the athlete might not want to hear it. And they're not engaged on their campus and are at their high school and government and leadership and Habitat doing community service and Habitat humanity, and they ran fast. I got a hard feeling with the opportunity. But I'm not talking to you two. I'm talking to anyone and everyone. Being liked is not a major deal for me.
Yeah.
Not
for us either.
Yeah, yeah. Hey, look, Coach, we're 100% with everything you're saying, man.
That's not me.
We're like,
I completely agree with you, Coach Fry. I mean, obviously, you know, you may have a bit more wisdom than the both of Adrian and I, but I think for us being able to kind of analyze all this and know our role. And yes, we do know we have a huge responsibility. And I think it's important to also let the student athlete know, even in the recruiting process. You know, I say to some of the recruits, you could be the number one, kid in the country. That doesn't necessarily mean that I want you if that's the only skill that you have to bring to the program, to bring to our community that we've developed. You know, we're looking for good people, people who want to contribute to the positive team culture, people who want to be active, and people who are agreeing to be on the, to have the same work ethic, both in the classroom and on the track, and be involved. I think a lot of the questions that I receive from student athletes is, you know, is there opportunity for me to be involved in campus, or do you only want me to go to track practice? Am I only allowed to do this? Am I only allowed to take these classes? Can I not take this major? And I tell them, I laugh a little bit. I was like, absolutely not. We encourage you guys to be involved on campus. We encourage you. We have so many diverse majors across the team at large. I'm not trying to restrict you just for a sport. You know, this is, we're trying to develop the all-around person and not exclude anything else. You know, so I think we do understand that. And I think another important part of it, and I'm sure, you know, Adrian does it as well, is to have one-on-one meetings with athletes and have group meetings with athletes to not only discuss, you know, their plan, but to be able to establish the relationship that you're not just the coach. You know, you don't want to be their parent. They already have parents, but you're more so, you know, you're their coach, you become a confidant, you're also a disciplinarian, but you're someone who they're going to be able to build that trust and relationship with, because once they feel comfortable with that and in a welcoming and warming environment, you know, that performance level spikes in all areas, that confidence spikes in all areas. So, I mean, that's just a nutshell. I'm not, you know, I don't want to go on and talk so much because we love hearing from you, but we do understand, and it's especially someone like myself who is not, you know, I'm a coach, I'm a woman, I'm a Black woman, you know, so there's a lot of different things that come with being that, and the representation and examples and the communication and the type of language that I'm putting out there. So we get it, and we try to encourage as well.
I mean, and you are, both of you are, and I'm just want to reiterate and
reiterate a little bit now, Coach.
Huh?
There you go. Now a little bit more.
You can see.
Now we can see you.
Okay.
every chance I get an opportunity, I try to come as hard as I can. And I put myself in a position because I may not get that opportunity again. And but my biggest thing is to make something better and make it better longer. And if someone came to South Carolina and they left the same, I'd be so disappointed.
Yeah.
If they're the same when they're 30 years old, I'd be broke. And if 50, they hadn't grown. If you hadn't changed any, and you hadn't, if you stay the same all the time, to me that's sad. That means the initial plant, the initial seed, the initial people in your life invested. They wasted their investment. It's almost having a person born and the parent, and the person doesn't see the parent. I know that's a lot of pressure, and nowadays it's really pressure because it costs kids $50,000, $60,000, and $70,000, and they're going to have to pay back loans and to catch up to being able to own a home. Not understanding the value of the dollar and how to invest the dollar and grow it, and how African-American wealth hasn't grown. Because they couldn't own a home, and wealth in America has grown because of ownership of home and the neighborhood you grew up in. Why? And losing your identity because you got an education and putting yourself in harm's way, thinking that because you graduated from Ivy, that keeps you from having a responsibility back to your neighborhood. No other Some people would call me biased and racist. I'm not. I'm an exposist. I believe in exposing everybody to being able to make us a better generation and world. And that, and so I think it's an opportunity for you to educate and become a person, study the history of the country, so you can help your whole teams, all of you that are listening. My goal was to become the head sprint coach at Duke University. After I got through being an assistant coach at East Carolina and went to being a high school coach, I wanted to be a high school football coach. I tried to get to be the high school football coach at my high school, at my town, the one where I integrated. They called me up to be one. They interviewed me. They finished the interview. And I had come off of being the assistant coach to a team that had won the 4A Eastern State Championship and a runner-up in the state. I was sure that this losing high school, they had lost for 5 years in a row. They had had winning seasons almost since the time I had left high school. I'm almost 100%. I came from East Carolina. I had exposure with Pat Dye. I coached at a 4A school, and I get the phone call, and this is going to be my breakthrough. I'm going to be the head coach in my hometown. I'm pumped up. I'm going for it. I get to take my little kids. I got twins that at that time that are 6 year, no, they're 4 year old, and my daughter oldest is six. I'm pumped because I'm taking back where my mother and grandmother and all can have them home for every Sunday. This is just going to be it. I go through the interview. They take me out to the office where the superintendent lives. I'm thinking that it's, you know, when I finish, they said, well, we're going to get back to you. We're going to make another interview and we'll get back to you. But I go home. I'm feeling good. That's crazy. Really, man, we've got to have it. I get home, and that night I didn't get any call, but the next day I did. It says, good news, Chris. We're so glad we figured out a way how to get it done. He said, well, okay. So we need you here to help get the black kids out for football, and we're going you're gonna be the assistant coach to – the what? My brother was like, well, I'm an assistant coach at a 4A school that's winning championships. And I'm going to come back and get the kids out again so y'all can win. And I'm going to assist a guy who was a manager who washed the clothes as a GA at NC State that I knew. And I go like, are you kidding me? Not from the community. And I said, no, thank you. It hurt me. I was almost done at that point. I said, you know what? It ain't God's plan for me to be a head coach. I done the interview. We won. I got all the black kids out of this school. We had 17% at Douglas Byrd High School. And they had won. When I got there, they had the losingest record in the state of North Carolina. They had 32 consecutive loss in football.
Terrible.
In 4 years, they brought in a head coach. I came with him. We won two football games. They fired him. No, he left because he couldn't pass the test. They hired another guy. We 2 years. We turned those two wins into five. Well, I've been on both staffs. Most of the kids I got out and on the JV teams that I was coaching, we'd won championships. I know I'm going to be the head coach. They went out and they hired someone that had 40 years of coaching experience and had won high school state championships. I understood. He kept me on his staff so I could help him keep the players because they only want to play for me. So when I can't get the head job there and I can't get it at my high school, I say, well, I'm just going to be the best PE teacher, track coach that I can be. And I did that for 4 years and we won. And then I went on to be runner up in the state track. And then the phone call rang from my high school football coach, college football coach named Pat Dye, who I helped recruit in East Carolina, who died this week, is the Auburn AD and Auburn head football coach. He called me because I helped him recruit, and recruiting was what I was good at, and that helped me. He called me to want me to come to Wyoming to be the head track coach. My wife said, no, we got three kids, and it's 17th of April, and it's 17 inches of snow in Laramie, Wyoming, and she wouldn't budge. I called Coach Dye. Saturday morning, and he said, you're at the airport? I said, no. And he said, well, I know who runs your house. And he said, goodbye. So I said, I'm stuck. I'm going to be here at Douglas Bird High School, and I'm happy, and I'm getting a raise, and I'm the track coach, and I'm winning. I'm good. I've got 7 years in my tenure. I hit tenure year. I don't need nothing. I can just go get a beer and fix the back of my house and let my kid. I'm a hero in the neighborhood. Phone rings, Raleigh Geiger, NC State University. Tom Jones had left and gone to UTEP. And he said, there's a guy in Fayetteville that used to coach college track. He's good. He's got all these kids out running club track. These are the guys that we're recruiting, Tim Worley and all these All-American football players and Donnell Wolford and all of that. Hey, you need to interview him. He wasn't even talking about me. He was talking about Jeff Blunt. They interviewed me, and yes, I was the guy that coached East Carolina. Jeff Blunt, head coach of Fayetteville State.
Was this by accident?
By accident.
Oh, that's great.
But the thing that kept it good that I'd like for you guys to know, they did not have Facebook. They did not have Instagram. They can only contact a few people. In my growth as a young man, I didn't do everything right. Mm-hmm. And if they could have caught while I was a student, the fact that they were burning cars right off the edge of East Carolina University and that I was down there in that tumultuous time with those students right there in front of my dorm, if that could have been filmed, I probably wouldn't have gotten the job as the assistant coach at East Carolina. Marching and creating organizations called EBO, Independent Black Organization, running for a young Democrat while I was in college and leading that. Those things right there weren't in my resume. Nowadays, all of that would have been if someone could have judged me, which they did at that time to prevent me from becoming a head coach. They said I was too explosive as I went up the line. He's a good recruiter, but you know that's what he is. No. The word was that he is a piece of work. You got to deal with him because he gonna question authority. I had a lot of interviews. I didn't know why I couldn't get to my high school. It's because they said I was a good leader. But questioning authority was a problem. I was supposed to be a good coach, get people out, but keep your mouth shut. I ain't never get that. I didn't understand that. It held me back for 22 years to become a head coach. I was a piece of work for head coaches. I feel sorry and I apologize to them. Raleigh and them had to be strong men to go to their ADs after some of the things that I would have my athlete, not mine, the team athletes. At Florida, John Webb had to, I'm sure, had to apologize for me being active in on-campus activities and stuff that weren't appropriate at that time for the coaches because nobody else was doing it. I'm sure, I know Dennis Credit had issues. He let me go to speak to the AD when it came time for a raise because I was controversial about, I went to find out what everybody else's raise was that was being assistant, and we finished hiring everybody else. Things that you're supposed to get fired for. So, I know I gave him headaches at night times when he has a, man, I hired this guy, and he's out here. He's a member of this organization, the NAACP. He's a member of his church activities, and they are active in the community on race issues. I created animosity anywhere I went, so it was difficult for South Carolina to hire me. I become accustomed to the fact of people bringing me for an interview, and. Because I interviewed all around the country. So, but did I stop being Kurt Fry? No. And I didn't stop being Kurt Fry. And I knew I put myself in position of people to try to say, well, is he cheating on his wife? Is he being a good person? Is he stealing? The reason I asked you guys to tell you the young thing, try your best, and you can't be perfect, but try not to be a creep. Yeah, because that's what gets people in trouble with me. That's my line. There's enough adult things for a person to be involved in.
Yeah.
But leave the student athlete alone. Leave people that are 18 years old alone. Be age appropriate. Yeah. Go on out and party at the party age group. I am not going to be the 68-year-old man sitting in no club with no 25 to 27-year-olds. I don't know how a person feel comfortable in that world.
Yeah. I mean, Adrian and I, we talk and we have a no tolerance policy for...
Yeah. It's ridiculous. So coach...
Yeah,
I want to hear about 2002 national championship. And that had to be just amazing. And you know, I came into South Carolina right after that, so I got to see all of the energy and just it was a really a great time to be on the team, a good era to be a part of, and so you know. But I missed the year before. And tell me about that, the national championship.
Hey, just like the cross burner and the goals of my mother for us to be something special. The plan was to be the head coach at Duke University so my children could be could go over, and I was going to build a sprint program at Duke because people didn't have respect that African Americans could be really smart and fast. So I'm going to work hard at North Carolina to be that coach at Duke. So when Al retires, I'm going to go any chance I can get because Duke pays for your education if you work there. I didn't care about the salary because my kids were going to go to school free. Putting them in an environment. So my goals to win were seeded off of my admirations to be the head coach at Duke. And then all of a sudden I got this phone call from Mike McGee. They said they couldn't find a qualified African-American. So Darrell Anderson was at Kentucky, and he had a great run with a guy who won 100 meters and was on the Olympic team named Tim Harden. Well, Darrell is a strong brother. He went in, and his interview was he knew South Carolina and he knew the SEC, and he knew, so his things was he needed to have what it was in the SEC that it took to win. And what did it take to win? It takes the same amount of coaches they got in Florida, the same kind of budget to travel that they got at LSU and Tennessee. And the same, so he gave them a perfect layout. So I got to follow Daryl. Well, I undersold. I'm like, they asked me the questions. What do you need to be the head coach of South Carolina? I said, what do you have? They said, well, we got 3 full-time coaches. I said, what I need. They said, what kind of budget are you talking about? I said, what budget you have? And so I that's what I need. Only thing I ask, and I said this to Coach McGee, I said, Coach McGee, now, if you ever decide to hire me, then I'm going to make it miserable if I can't win. And he said, what do you mean by that? I said, if I can't get people in school and retain them to school, if I don't have resources for them to graduate from college, if somebody restricts me from getting a student experience, taking them on special trips or taking them to the beach or taking them to Washington, D.C., taking them to New York, whenever, just a few things, then I'm going to make it miserable. I will complain, not about the facility, but opportunities. And he said, you will never get turned down on getting a kid in school that anybody else can get in. And we will find a way for your students to find majors, and we'll get you tutors, and we'll help you keep them in school. So I went on. I said, well, he understands me. Well, we went on to win a gold medal with Alan Johnson in Atlanta. And it was the same time they were trying to hire. Cell phones weren't big. Oh, yeah, they were. It was a big car cell phone that I had. You had to take it in and plug it into the wall. It was about 6 inches tall, and it had a thing to hang on top of it. Yeah. I was cool. You know, you had to tie it to your belt to walk around. Well, we were in Atlanta, and I get a phone call. It's like in your house, Paul. The night that after Allen won, and it was Coach McGee, says, is that your boy that won? I said, yes, sir. He said, we want to offer you the head coach. The same night Alan Johnson won a gold medal, I was offered in 1996 the head coach. And I packed my family, and we drove from Atlanta to come to Columbia to look at it, because my wife didn't like the idea of me, of us moving from North Carolina to South Carolina. We had horrific ideas about South Carolina. North Carolina blacks have a different view is in South Carolina and Southern, South Georgia, North Florida, Alabama, Mississippi. So, and we're just as bad in racial relations in North Carolina as they are. But everybody thinks everybody else is better. It's like I'm just found when I went to New York to see my uncles. We talked about this yesterday. Racism is racism all over America. We found out in one of the most liberal cities in the world is Minnesota. Yeah. It's just a brick. If you go there, you find out, oh, my God, this is a nice place. People are communicating. The percentage of persons there are African-American, about 3 or 4%. So it looks like everybody's culturally acceptance. But now you see that there was some hostility there that changes the world. So my judgments were within my little confine of my little world, North Carolina, 85-95. So I came and I found the most loving people in Columbia, South Carolina. All our myths and concepts, take my salary doubled. So then I saw something in 1 year. Nothing, I had nothing to do with. Greg Kraft had left me here, Larry Judge, with a group of throwers. They were incredible. They scored 75 points in a conference meet. the first year I was here. I only had Tonique Williams and Charmaine Howell, who were two. One was 800 meter, the other was 400. So I combined them with Darn Ellaby and Lisa Messapica and the Throwers, and we went to the end season. We got four. But my dream, I saw on a wall, first to a national title in the weight room. The football team went 0-11. The basketball team was middle level SEC, and I started thinking, well, I had recruited what I thought should have won the national championship, but could never put together the University of North Carolina with Monique Hennigan, Natasha Colander, and Marion Jones.
Yeah.
And I left them there and came to Stockton. Now, they wouldn't train Milton Campbell and Curtis Johnson and Tony McCall and Ken Harnett. We had finished fifth in the country with the men, and we'd won a national championship in the 4x1 on the men's side, and Marion's foot was hurt, and we were just getting it done. Coach Craddock had a tremendous program, but Charles Foster left me a legacy so I could recruit off of. I mean, it's the easiest place in America. It had great academics. Black people would turn down scholarships to get an admission slot to come to Chapel Hill. Academics, I could find the best academic students in the country to come to school for almost free. And they had money because they wanted minorities on campus, so they had money available. So I got to be a friend with a minority recruiter. And he would give academic money for anybody that had 1150 on the SAT, and I found them. So I was stealing people from other people that didn't think that they could go to a prestigious school. So it was easy recruiting. It was stealing. Mm-hmm. So I left there and came to South Carolina. He hired me. And I saw that sign. And we got fourth. The first phone call I got was Tonique Williams, and she transferred. So we did well. The next year, Terrence Jamel made a phone call to me. No, I called him because I was recruiting Cannon to go to North Carolina, and I didn't sign him out of to go to North Carolina because I saw Terrence run because I plan on getting him next year. And Heaven talked to him. He was in he had a religious experience on his birthday. After having a visit, he went to his pastor, and his pastor said, "You will know there'll be a sign." Now, I'm a Christian guy, but physical signs, I don't know if I believe this, but I went on and took that. I said, "Yeah, you'll get a sign," because when he told me what the sign was, he drank milk, and he was in a bar. And the guy that was serving the bar, he had on his, Terrence had his leather jacket on. It had all his pins. He's a high school kid. He don't let nothing in his body that don't make him run fast. But his brother took him out for a dinner, but he had a bar. His brother is older than him by 4 years. He went up to get a drink, so he took Terrence up there with leather. The guy asked him, "Well, you run track. Are you good?" He said, "Yeah, I have the fastest time in the country, and I'm the national da da da." And all these leather, he went down, his leather jacket so full. Because for 4 years, he's been Georgia State champion. And the only one beat him in the enemy of hurdles was Angelo Taylor. Them two cats are on the same team.
Crazy.
So, big story, the guy behind the counter is a guy that was a 15-second hurdler that went to University of North Carolina. I got the guy down to running 13.9. So the guy said, "You hurdle? You the best? Well, I know the best hurdler coach in the world."
Yes,
and so it was a sign. The guy said, and Terrence asked him, "Who is it? What school?" He said, "Carolina." And Terrence said, "Well, I just came from visiting Carolina." Well, it was the wrong Carolina again. It was Chapel Hill. And so the guy said, "My coach is at Carolina." He said, "What's your coach's name?" He says, "My coach's name Coach Curtis Fry. And Terrence said, well, he don't coach the Chapel Hill. He says, yes, he do. And so they got an argument. And anyway, Terrence is a competitive person, so he wanted to prove to guy that I was at South Carolina. So he selected South Carolina where I was, and he went back to let the guy know where I worked at. So that's
This is how you get Terrence Trammell.
Was because Alan Johnson, Melissa Morrison, and that wall that was on the sign. Getting the number one class into school the first, second year of the year that I was there because of Alan Johnson with Demetria Washington. And her class gave me a chance to go and be second with the Barber twins and Demetria all coming in together. It gave me this tunnel of athletes that could compete and move us up to where we were the second best team in the country and something come up short. Bobby Kersey came out and helped UCLA two times, and we got second when I thought we were the best team in the country. And then, so the next time those kids became seniors, I got another number one class. And that number one class ended up being Lucinda Demas. Siobhan Stoddard. Erica Whipple, Alexis Joyce, and Tiffany Ross. And so whenever I had this cream that was Demetria and the Barber twins, and it meshed, and I added on in the middle of it a girl named Aileen Bailey. She was a vice transfer. So I knew I was putting puzzle pieces together. And so when it came to fruition, I thought I had a run, going to have a run. Some injuries hit us, and we didn't get that run because we've had about 5 years worth of being. I think in my office we got 17 Division I trophies between the men and the women. Out of that kind of group of leading us in to that run, but. Hey, it was exciting. It became a part of who we were. Then I had a couple of hires. I mean, I had to make a couple of hires. It got so big, I didn't have enough to be the sprint coach for men and women and underserving athletes, having a club with 18 kids in it. I mean, I have 18 people who've gotten gold medals in the World Championship or Olympic Games, 13 medals in the Olympic Games. Those things came mostly out of that era. Next great group, Natasha Colena Natasha Hastings and Shalana Solomon's group. Jason Richardson group. That group continued to roll a little bit. And your group, you know, you were that middle group between that with that Jonathan Fortenberry.
Oh, yeah.
If that guy don't get hurt, he's probably the greatest athlete.
I know. The best ankle. That anchor leg. We got to talk about 2002, man. That anchor leg. I mean, you watch the video and the whole time you're saying, like, Baylor, you know, Tennessee. And I'm like, are you guys watching the same race? You know, he's running on Darrell Williamson down in. And it was crazy because Gary Kakaia won the four, but he tied up in the 4x4.
Yeah.
And that was a crazy race, too, because I think Justin Gatlin split 44 mid or something like that. That was just an insane race, man.
Yeah.
And then the women won the meet. So you got to talk a little bit about the meet, Coach. I want to hear about that 2002 championship.
Well, you know, the thing in that meet was
bring the camera down for me, Coach.
We knew that we had people in the we knew building that meet, the pieces we had to have and to win that meet as we recruited and signed the classes. Mm-hmm. We knew the 400 and the intermediate hurdles was what we had to have. So if you know, Lashenda Demas didn't win the championship because she, in the open intermediates, because she ran the 400 meters and ran the intermediate hurdles.
Yeah. That's
insane.
Like, that's, you know, Lashenda Demas, that's an amazing performance. Mm-hmm. Running an open four and the intermediates at the national championship, come on.
I remember now, you had to run a trial semi and final too.
Yeah. And her race was on the 4x4 as well, right?
Yep, she had trials and finals. So she ran, and then those days on the same day. So she had four races, and then she had her relay trial. But I had enough people to get through. Because now, remember, we got four people in the finals of the three in the intermediates. Lashenda, Tiffany, and Siobhan.
Yeah.
Intermediates. And in the quarter, you end up with Demetria, and Lisa, and Lashenda. So we scored 20 points in both those races.
Yeah.
And then Lisa and Aileen, they were 200 meters. And then, but what shook us was when a French by Aileen in 100 meters, and she got DQ'd the day before, which devastated us. But then, but Lisa ran a tremendous leg on the 4x1 alone, because our big deal was Erica Whipple was probably the best sprinter we had, but she had a little contingent tinge.
What was that?
But saw Erica Whipple. She she had a hamstring that just, we never got rid of the scar tissue, so she could have only about one race a day. That time she got hurt in high school. She was to be the next FloJo. She ran 11:35 out of Florida as a sophomore, and I had followed her all the way up and ended up getting her up here to be the one that got Khalil Carpenter and them in. So she was the leadoff leg of that 4x1. Demetria ran 2, and Barbara ran 3 and just killed the curve, and Aileen brought it home and won the national championship. That was that part. So we had the 3 in that hurdles, the 3 and the 400, and then we had a young lady by the name of she gonna kill me. South Florida long jumper Antoinette. Antoinette. Antoinette Wilk. And to see the bass, all American. She was all American in the heptathlon and got 6. Antoinette got 5th in the long jump. So we were scoring. We had diversified by then and didn't have the power in the throws because I spent the money all over the place and I kind of we couldn't get the big time throwers. Because those had been developed, we actually were throwing on concrete field. Reputation of our facilities took a beating, and so we couldn't continue that route of getting the great throwers. We brought in great ones because I had 2 great coaches, Coach Sargent and Coach Larry Judge. I had left us a great group, but I couldn't continue that group, so I brought in what my strength was hurdling and sprinting. And that we put it together, and our deal was we had to meet one. And I had a choice to make on making everybody that traveled to the meet an All-American making the national record for the 4x4 for women be where it could never be touched. And to see the Bass had not scored And the deal was Lisa Barber had ran 50.88, and Tecito was a 53-second quarter miler. We ran 3:26.18, and all we had to do with this is get the just get around the track. So Tiffany Ross led off, who could run, who was a 51-second. Demetri Washington, who was third in the 400, who run 51 flat, could run 51 flat, but run relay legs much faster. And so their jobs were just to have us in front. And then Tecito, or use Mickey, Lisa Barber. And I decided to go with Tecito because Lisa had run the quarter, the 200, the 4x1, and I was nervous about if she pulls a hamstring. I mean, I'm not adding points at that time. I don't know we're going to win by 30 points. I'm just making sure we get around. And I made the decision not to run Lisa and ran to Cedar. And then and I asked Lashinda to don't go for anything, just get us around the track. And it, hindsight, no, I'm happy to see the guy to be an All-American. But, boy, if we go out there and Lisa Barber, she's jacked up. If she takes the stick and we got the lead, she going to try to bear. She was that kind of athlete as she went on to be a pro, as you know. She bears. She runs with lids and with an iron stick in her mouth. She's gonna bear anybody anytime. And Lashinda Demus and she would jack Demetra and Lashinda Demus up. She'd had them swagging and rocking and dancing. And but we might have dropped the stick like John did. but it was a great. It was great having that fun. And out of that, to see the careers and to see the mothers they become and the wives that they've become. That's the joy of the 2002. And then the way the university has appreciated them and bringing them back. Sometimes the things that they went through, people don't understand. You know this very well. You know that we never had a bathroom and our women had to, we had Porta Johns and problems with people taking care of those on the site, while other teams had bathrooms and locker rooms, and we had fences and gates that were problems to get into a field to do some grass work, and we had to go to a hill, and we threw on a concrete slab, and so there are things that I don't like to think those kids overcame. Our we get locked out and we couldn't be in the weight room. And then we had an indoor place that was a square track. We had to fight to see when our opportunity was to be there. And if somebody else called, we couldn't go in. So there were issues that we battled to make sure that group of kids, they never knew nothing about it. They just lined up and go. But we had a great sponsor. I mean, I knew that we didn't have any money. I took the job knowing that. But Nike at that time, because I've had a good relationship with Marion Jones and Chapel Hill, that Lou Ellen, he wasn't the guy then, Caparotti, totally sponsored me, fully. So I could travel and do anything financially. I knew because of that, because of Alan Johnson being here, I had unlimited, because I could just get Cap to give me the money to put the uniform or the shoes or to travel to however I want to travel, whatever hotel I want. I could exceed the budget that we had at the university. So I didn't put our university in debt by doing the things for our kids. I made sure our kids got what they needed to be successful. They didn't know where it came from. They just know, hey, they lived in the biggest in Manhattan, the best hotel they knew that when we went to Philadelphia, they lived in the best. Now, they didn't get big-time meal money.
No, but we stayed in the best locations, that's for sure. We didn't get the most per diem, but we stayed in some good locations.
And we would go to Miami.
And we got hooked up with nice new stuff at National Shades and the whole outfit, the new Nike watch.
Oakley was my other sponsor. And then I had personal sponsor with Oakley. I did the Michael Jordan camp. So coming through the fruition of going through the struggle of the cross burning, but the relationships I built were the people that took care of my mother. When my mother was ill with pancreatic cancer, or when my mother couldn't get tires on her car, and I wasn't there to take her car or take her to the hospital, same people that walked across that field were the same people that went to get Miss Fry and took care of her, that made sure that when the rain drenched that dirt road, that they took their trucks and drug that road so it'd be smooth for Curtis' mom. So I never stop loving people or write people off. Today, people ask me why I don't eliminate people off of something as simple as, because y'all take Facebook friends as your friend. You know, people ask you to be a friend, but so they ain't your friend. Get rid of
them. We're not that young, Coach Fry. We're in our 30s. We're still, I remember rotary phones. We're not that young.
Man, I get people to ask me, tell me, you hadn't accepted me. I was like, dude, it ain't that serious.
I post on Facebook, but I'm not really looking at Facebook. I don't know.
But there are people in your age group, there are prominent people. That take it serious. Y'all Instagram folk take it serious.
Let me tell you, if I wasn't a coach, I would never use any of that. I don't like social media. I just do it because it's like you kind of have to. Like, look at you, you're like an expert. I see you post everywhere all the time, so you picked it up pretty quickly. I don't like it, but at the end of the day, it's how we're all connected now. This is what the world is, and so you could try to hold, you know, and resist it, or you just got to learn. But I do think it's good to take a break from, absolutely.
I think that just as I was raised to be a part of the NAACP and to be a leader at the Boy Scouts and to be the president of the student body, or to be the guy that motivated the kids to come back out when they walked out, when we boycotted my high school and go to the bus and turn them around to come play, to get people, recruit people. I think I have a mission and a cause, and I think each of us have one. All of you do. Mm-hmm. You're worthy. You got to have more people that want to be like you, because your influence on them is almost insurmountable. You don't understand your power. And if you're not using yours, someone else is. Yeah. The reverse order of negative is positive.
Right.
Exposure and education. I don't do this for me. I think my trips to Egypt and to show the possibilities of a boy that come from where somebody threw a shot over top of the house for a little. It is not a how it is that you did. If that guy who writes broken sentences on Facebook can get all the way there, why can't I? That guy who rambles when he speaks, who barely reads while he's watching things in front of a stage of 3,000 coaches and is blundering through and just drops it and goes on and goes into his preaching lingo, that guy travels to Egypt, and that guy understands ground touch and strikes and stride length and increased frequency. That guy runs over top of tire flats on the ground so he increases in acceleration. He can't, man. I don't know nothing about that. That guy's had 12 NCAA in a row, Final Four, but one team? Nah. And I ain't got nothing. I haven't had nobody qualify for the Nationals. But I'm a genius. You guys do so many good things. Just what I heard from you guys about the exposure and attention. I love watching when you show when there's a person being admitted to Cornell University and the diversity of the people you bring in. I love every time I see, I don't know your name, babe. You have to tell me, but I see your face. I see you at the convention. I see you active inside of every.
You know what, Coach? It's Portia.
Coach, this is Coach Portia Dobson, Associate Head Coach at UPenn. Yep. There we go.
I speak to Portia every time.
Wait a second. Didn't he recruit you?
Sort of.
Probably.
Coach, you recruited her. She was a hurdler.
No, where was I at when I recruited her?
You were in South Carolina. You were just saying that you speak to me all the time, which you do. You speak to me everywhere you speak at track meets, conventions, Zoom calls.
That's because you're actively involved in being better than you were yesterday. I don't have to know the name to take ownership of who you are. Our relationship is, I consider us like you my kid. You my athlete. I'd be so disappointed in anything you did because I know you got better sense than to be there doing it. And that's why when I don't do some things, it ain't because I don't want to, it's because I know I'll disappoint you. That's considered every time I'm getting ready to do it. I be acting silly and ugly and loving people, hugging people, flirting, acting up. My wife gets on me. I stop.
Hey, man, social distancing, Coach.
Oh, God, that is going to make me a hero now.
He can't be hugging everybody, man.
Hey. You're right. That's why they ain't let me in the house.
You say you've been working out. You've been keeping that up, right?
Yeah, I just came from my office. I'm the same way at my church.
Amen.
But you, I want you guys to hold yourself to a higher accountability. Adrian, don't ever lose the faith. Because when I got ready to feel like the road was ending, and you can almost get into depression whenever you've done all the things you think you should be doing,
and
the opportunity doesn't make itself available. Don't tear down nobody. This is where I am. I'm going to make this ditch the best ditch. I'm a ditch digger, and I'm going to dig this ditch. It's going to be the best ditch that anybody's ever seen. That's who I am.
Yeah.
I mean, that's Martin Luther King. And it's on anything that you do, your name going to be on it. And if it ain't, my daddy was very clear about it. Collecting garbage was what we did. He had a garbage truck. I left some stuff. That was once I got to be 18 years old. On Saturday, he used to go get stuff because he worked for the garbage. The garbage people would say there's stuff you weren't supposed to pick up. They're supposed to take it to the dump.
You pick it all up?
My daddy would say, y'all don't have to take rich people don't have to take their stuff to dump because my children, my guys are going to come by there with this old truck and they're going to get it. So when we got old enough to drive around on Saturdays, we got a little extra money by doing it. And my daddy lost a job of a house because my brother and I, we had moved up where we star athletes at high school. we are not putting that rotten thing. I'm not picking it up. And my brother, I ain't picking it up. We left it. We pick everything around it. I don't forgot what it was, but we won't get it. My daddy lost that job, and he lost the next door neighbor.
Wow.
He had always told us to do it. And then I read it when I got to college, that if you do a job so well, then you can ask somebody to increase the pay.
Right. I mean,
but if you do it so poorly, nobody wants you.
Yeah.
So anytime you do something, you do it so well that they say, well, that cat, well, he might be a pain, but that song gun can recruit. Mm-hmm. That song gun is going to be in the community, and he's going to win the black community over. That guy is going to help the homeless in his community. Boy, yeah. I tell you what, he brings a lot of things to the table. We can overlook the fact that he's going to be verbal and vocal and visible.
Well, there's one more thing I want to ask you about, Coach, before we let you go, because we've had you on air for a while. You're super busy. How you know, given your background and involvement with, you know, civil rights, what do you have to say with what happened with George Floyd and what's going on right now in the country, and, you know, just with, you know, being a track coach, just all the young black student athletes that we have to deal with, and right now a lot of them are hurting and going through stuff. So just, I just wanted to hear your thoughts on just any of it.
I think hurt for a person of a certain age is what people tell you. I spoke to our kids last night and trying to get them, they do have a feeling. Mm-hmm. It's that age group above them, between the ones that are really employed, that are probably 27 years old, that have to make a decision. Have they sent a message to somebody they care about and love? Mm-hmm. I really hurt for people who are white, that have black friends, that have made the statement of don't use the race card, or that I'm not racist. I really do, because they got to be asking themselves some questions. Did they take it serious when they seen the single black person in the room hear an offensive statement? Did they go and confront the person that did they hire the most qualified person, or did they take an easy route and hire somebody they're familiar with? And is familiar race identification? Is it a social familiar? So since this race is an issue, is not an issue, and you don't see color, then did you give the raise to the most qualified, or do you give more hours to the nurses that are of color so that the one that's your friend don't get contaminated or exposed? I have serious questions, but for our kids, I don't think they're there. They want to say, I love everybody. And they do, too, because they don't have the maturity or the number of years. They are going to react to the latest song and who the best color and what color toenails and what color hair. I've been in this 45 years. I know what's expedient and what's in vogue. This year seems to be a little bit more. I got a guy named Quincy asking most of the questions. His biggest concern was, y'all be careful out there, because there's some people that's throwing bricks and sticks, and I think the police might have them there, so they're going to shoot you. Be careful there. His concepts are more about being involved, but what's happening in the present, not the future, not the past. Because the future the past, he felt like he deal with it, because if somebody disrespects him, he going to immediately, 18 to 22, going to deal with your disrespect. It's when disrespect you deal with has consequences. Whenever you speak up to an issue and you get fired and nobody hired you because somebody put something on your file because of your color, and were you the person that put it in the file because you disagree with the person's issue? It's the same with some black women got a double. Did you participate, or were you advanced on your job because of you wore your top low or skirt high? And if you didn't, did you get removed from the job because you didn't, somebody tried to ask you to go a place you didn't want to go, or you didn't go out with the group or the individual? Or did a person ask you to do that and you said no, but you didn't get advanced? They got to ask themselves some serious questions, because they got power. A kid from 18 to 22 are powerless to influence the other 18 to 22. They don't have, but it's when they have power, they know they got power. They change from being that good little friend. And that's the thing that we have a great opportunity. I'm so proud of the powerless that they could use theirs to make this a social event. They could be at the beach like they were doing the Kavara. Them same kids that went to the beach and said this was a joke, that I'm going to have my spring break. They changed when this guy, when someone stepped on a guy's neck and they washed the air. They don't know what they saw, but they know when they see somebody treat somebody like an animal. It's a different feeling for each one with the experience of how tight or their personal relationship with somebody of color. But it's going to have persons of color ask the question, did I tolerate or did I continue that young energy I had when somebody disrespected me? All of us were in a situation where we did not have responsibility. We didn't have a car payment. We did not have a moving out of our house of our family, and we had to pay our own insurance bill. All of us, before that occurred and you didn't have obligations, your ability to step up when you saw wrong. Adrian Durant did not want to run workouts that made him be a 400 meter guy. He was 18 to 22. He confronted that. When he got to be 30 years old, or if it had been that he was going to lose his scholarship, or there was threats to it that had consequences, his ability or will to verbalize that would have been among his peers. What we deal with right now is, how do we keep an eye, and how do we get them to keep an eye on each other? This is probably the most segregated time since I left high school. Kids don't want to, they want to have their own music. They want to have their own roommate.
Lower your camera.
Their own section on the bus.
Bring your camera, coach.
You can't see you, coach.
You can't see you, coach. There we go.
I think this is probably a segregated time. It's got to get up, but it's segregated by choice, not by force.
But you know, I'm an optimist. I see a lot of positive in how some of these young kids are responding and dealing with this issue. And I've seen a lot of them who are taking it very seriously and are showing an understanding of the history of what's been happening, because it's almost like this is the straw that broke the camel's back. So, you know, I'm seeing some more maturity than I would have expected, and people calling out the issue. And, you know, and I'm telling you, their avenue is social media. That's how they're connecting and talking. And if you're following, they are swarming on social media. And they're not being shy about the issues right now.
Yeah,
I agree.
It's it falls in line, you know, with them being an all-around person. They're academics. They've done their research. You know, we found that they're writing letters. They're speaking up. They're referring to history. So it's 50-50, right? We need to continue to support those students and those young people who are doing that and who are aware of it. And like you said, it's almost a challenge their peers, their 18 to 22 peers, to do the same. And not only that, you know, they're also bringing awareness and educating folks who are older than them, you know? So we are seeing some of that.
I think both of you are right, but I think the challenge is, as in vogue things go, the latest and the most popular, what everybody does, that's what people do.
Our challenge is going to be,
and there's a fear of the people above them to allow that. And I see where there are companies from Silicon Valley, and there are people in Manhattan. It's in vogue, but the terror, the proof in the pudding is not in the midst, of the battle. It's when the battle appears to be over. Are you going to hire anybody?
Yeah.
Are you going to continue to go to the march?
Yeah.
Are you
going to change?
Are you going to contribute to the change? Are you going to buy from people that make contributions to racist hate? Are you going to do the research to see who that is? We are what we repeatedly do. We are who we repeatedly hang out with. We are who we
You are the roll.
Let me stay on the good side of things.
Yeah.
I am an optimist. I believe I'm going to love you anyway. Like I told you, man, I'm not getting rid of people who say racist, mean things on my, but I'm going to keep being me, and they know I'm going to be me.
I might mute those folks so I don't see their posts, but I'll still, you know.
But they going to come. I want to impact them.
Right. Yeah.
But I can tell I know who you are. I am not surprised on your post. I am not surprised on person that attacks me. They think they are coming out and going like, well, Curtis, I didn't know you were that kind of guy. I knew you were that kind of guy.
Yeah, exactly.
So well, don't
you've been to me one the whole time. And, you know, I get those same kind of, you post something and they're like, oh, let's keep it about track and field. Like, no, how are you going to just say the only thing I'm allowed to speak about? I am a black male and I lived this experience, and so I'm allowed to comment. I'm allowed to comment.
Well, you know, I'm going to. So you knew that.
Yeah,
my wife struggled with who I am, and my brothers and my sisters and everybody. Well, you're a public employee.
I'm posting online. Yeah, you're a public figure, Coach.
Yeah, well, you know, everybody that's public around me, they're more disappointed in where I'm speaking one way and I'll leave out is, and they go like, man, I don't understand what you were saying. And I said, well, maybe I need to go edit it. Then my wife will steal the phone from me and go through it and edit what I just did. She'll correct it so bad that it doesn't mean
what you were trying to say.
Yeah, I said, wait a minute. I meant what I said. I said what I meant. I just left off.
Go back to put what I said before.
Yeah. I don't know. Maybe I needed a comma, but the comma changed what I just said. You know, right. Let them think about it. Yeah, they're going to reread what I said to try to figure out.
You know, it's funny you make a good point. I had a professor once who actually made that point. He didn't like how people wrote because he said how you wrote writing is not really how you're thinking or feeling because you have all this punctuation and grammar. So he actually used to encourage us just to write, just let it come out and don't, you know, put any punctuation. It was hilarious, but and this was in college.
You know, if you look at me, I capitalize things, and somebody's, what is he yelling? Well, I didn't know. I didn't know capitalizing everything was thing I was doing. So it Well, once I did learn that, that was early on in social media. I didn't understand that. Man, so when you see me capitalizing, it's an emphasis. And then, yeah, I'm not yelling. I'm just that's my point. Mm-hmm. I love my mother. So mother's in capital letters.
Yeah,
well,
yeah,
why the rest of the team is small? So why do you put an exclamation point? Well, and I know that exclamation emphasis, or I put quotations around a word. It was about why is it quote? Because I want that person to emphasize my thought. No, you can say, well, he misquoted it and missaid it. It is not a quote. It is not that belongs to everybody. Well, that's good, but you read that sentence.
And we all know what you mean by now, Cole. Yeah. Don't worry about it.
We do know what you mean. And like you said, you do it because that you know regardless, people are going to read it and you want to impact people. And Coach Wright, you've impacted probably, I know you've impacted a lot, but probably so much more than you know. And it goes way beyond your accolades and your accomplishments. Obviously, those are things that attract people and bring attention to you. But once the attention is there, then people get to know, wow, there's a lot more to this. There's a lot more to how he's able to really produce this success. And they get more into who Coach Fry is. And that is why, you know, we enjoy listening to you. We enjoy hearing, you know, the advice that you give to us and your experiences. And your I was telling Adrian before, you know, I said it's all
interesting.
And I love even my little connection to you. You know, I'm a Tar Heel, and that's one of the places where you started and you continued on and used that assistant coach experience and that recruiting experience. And then in a place where both Adrian and I, you know, we've been there. And then the elevation into what you need to do as a head coach and the responsibilities and the lives that you've impacted. And it's, you know, like Adrian said, we're in our 30s. You know, we're in our 30s, we're young Black coaches who we know we're making an impact and we enjoy the success. But again, like you are following you, the athletic success is what brings the attention, but then people are able to see what's happening underneath the surface. And we have good examples, you know, and one of those examples are you. I mean, it doesn't hurt that you're a Hall of Fame coach either, you know, so.
Yeah, Coach Olympic gold medalist over there.
Well, I tell you what, hey, Adrian, yeah, every time she's on, I'll come back on.
She's always on.
I feel so honored and man, this if you say I'm speechless, can you ever get me where I'm speechless?
Even things so simple, Coach Fry, you were on a Zoom call about a month ago, and there were college and high school coaches on it, and we were about to get off the call, and you saw me on, and you kept saying, hi, Portia, and then I received so many text messages after, just like, Coach Fry knows you? Who's that? You know, I was like, yeah. So I felt
you're
good.
So beautiful.
Yeah, he knows who I am.
Adrian, now I'm going to really be blowed up, man. you guys, I'm honored. You're always family. I got your back.
Appreciate you, Coach.
I got your back. I got you.
Hey, and thanks for coming on.
Yeah.
We got to get you on here again to talk to us again, man.
I'm just telling you, remember this. I got your back, but I also will take my belt to you.
That's all I'm talking about.
Nobody else got to know it. But if you can take yours to me. I relinquished the responsibility that if you, he said, Coach, I need to talk. It's okay. Coach Fry, I was hurt. This here bothers me. And I'm good. I don't do it all right. Guarantee you I don't. So anytime you were bothered or hurt, I don't want our relationship to be one where it's one direction. because I'm not going to let it be my fault that I don't have a relationship with you.
Yeah, no, I appreciate
it. I will text you or I will look at you wrong. You know, you will know that I hurt because we got the relationship. It's your responsibility. If you look at me, I'm going to try to fix it. And I think you should carry that. It'll keep you from being waking up at 4 a.m. Do it, sleep on it, but don't let it be 2 days before you correct a meaningful relationship.
Yes, sir.
That's good stuff.
And yeah, I appreciate
the word right there. Thank you, guys. I appreciate you having me on.
Hey, thank you. Thanks for coming on.
Thank
it was
you.
Great.
2 o'clock to 4:30. 4:43. Oh my God. 3:43. Oh,
I was about to say, I hope it's not 4:43.
It's 3:43.
Oh no.
43 minutes. Oh my God.
Hey, man, that's how it should be. I just, you know, normal conversation. You know, it's not an uptight interview. You know, we just want to talk to you. So we appreciate it, Coach. Thanks for giving us the time.
Yeah.
Hey, amen. I'm out of here.